Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll call a meeting to order. Trustee Kovac here. Trustee Gendrich here. Trustee Green
here.
Trustee Vandenhoven is here. Trustee Dart
here.
Trustee Gast is excused. Trustee Zeller
here.
Are there any recommended modifications to the agenda this evening? Is there anyone with us that would like to see an item moved up or down on the agenda? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the agenda as submitted. Trustee Gendrich, second. Trustee Kovac, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Are there any announcements this evening? Brad.
Maybe you can hear me fine. Just to give you a little heads up, Ray knows about this, but the Miracle League concession building is broken into sometime between Saturday mid-morning through Monday early morning. Right now we're figuring between damage to locks and things that have been stolen, about $2,000.
What was that? Which
one? Miracle League.
Miracle League. Did they actually gain entry and take off with the stuff in the building?
They forced two exterior doors open. We're going to be replacing those locks with deadbolts. And then once they got inside, they got into another room that had a lock on it, forced that door open, and took microphones and
amplification equipment stuff.
Wow.
Something will turn up.
How was the, Brad, just a question, how was the liability, handled for property loss like that? How are we set up with the league? Because I think it may be more than $2,000 from what I'm gathering. I don't know.
Our deductible is $1,000, but that would cover the stuff that is the villages, not this, the equipment and stuff that was stolen. Actually, it's the Miracle League.
Okay.
So, like, is the locks being broken on the building and stuff, our deductible would be $1,000. And the cost of replacing those right now, I think, we're around six. Yeah. So probably $600 for the box.
Brad, where are we with the camera program? We were thinking about installing cameras. I know we were probably having a problem at Webster for quite a while.
Right. This is the first incident we've had in quite some time. So we'll be back at the cameras.
Do we have cameras at all the parks?
We moved them around. So
okay.
At this point, we're not at that park.
And how much does it cost per camera?
The latest ones that we purchased were just over $100 each.
And how many do we have? How many do we?
We have six so far.
And usually you put two at a site or three, or how does it work?
Depending on how much coverage we're looking at, if there's several access points to an area, then we'll put more than two.
So could we use more? I mean, if we had more, would it be helpful?
The type of camera we're using, probably not. But if we got into other types of security aspects, other remote cameras with the DVD players and stuff that would audio or would record everything for 24 hours, we don't have any of those.
And right now, what do we have? Sort of like the deer camera kind of recording?
Correct. That you can put both as a recording and or a photo.
Okay. Thanks. Any other announcements? Yes, Tracy.
Just a couple of quick ones. I have samples of the polo shirts. If anybody is interested in ordering one, there's some size samples over here. So after the meeting, if you want to take a look and pick a size or whatever, then just get back to Carrie. I also have colors here if anybody wants to pick color. So just let me know and take a look at them if someone's interested in that at all. The other thing I just wanted to know, the community videos are in. Those are the videos that we did. There were the three and then the one welcome from the village president. We just got them in today. And what I was planning to do was maybe have Steve review them, and we have to approve or ask for any changes, so then we'll go through that process, and hopefully they'll be up within, you know, depending on how much changes we have, maybe within the next couple weeks they'll be up on the website. And they look pretty good. There's some changes we would like in all of them.
Smiling, Mark.
No. Yeah. So if Steve, you can maybe look at them, and I can either email to you or whatever, and take a look.
I have editorial privileges. That's, yes, you do. Pixelate my entire face for the welcome video. Is that it?
That's it.
Any other announcements? All right. Item number 4, paid time off presentation and contract discussion with Patrick Glenn.
Patrick is here formerly from Calumet County. He worked at Calumet County for many years, and that's where I met him when I was down with Tom Harrison. And he kind of started working with us early this year. He just came in and helped us get some ideas going. Since that time, he has gone to Carlson Detman Consulting and is doing and working for them in this county. So I had asked him to come and do a presentation, talk about the contract that we had talked about at our last meeting, and then answer questions that you may have on contract or PTO. So he's going to do a short presentation on PTO just to kind of see if everybody understands exactly what it is and how it would work, and then go into his contract with it.
Where's it most comfortable? Here?
Microphone. Probably okay. Here by the microphone.
Okay. As Tracy said, my name is Patrick Glenn. I'm from Carlson Detman Consulting. My career has spanned about 19 years thus far. I've worked for three county governments around the state, and so I've gotten my flavor of local government, the public sector. And in about 2003, Calumet County went down the path of PTO. And so began an extensive series of research to do that. And then with the budget repair bill, I was selected to serve as a chair for an employee benefits consortium for the Wisconsin Counties Association. And one of the main charges was PTO. And I went through reams upon reams upon reams of paper on paid time off plans. And I know more about them than I think I would ever care to know. And little did I know that perhaps it might pay off at some point down the road. But one of the things that Tracy had asked that earlier this year, she alluded to, is to sit down with some of the area administrators and just talk about PTO plans in general. And the Wisconsin Public Employer Labor Relations Association, say that three times fast, 2 years ago did a statewide survey of those employers who had PTO plans, and the number was about 10%, which is pretty common in terms of public sector employers that line up for PTO plans. 90% have traditional plans, 10% have PTO. Where the public or the private sector is closer to anywhere between a 25 and a 40% with PTO plans, depending on which study you look at. But the point of it was that the study also indicated that between 40 and 50% of private sector employers were looking at going to a PTO plan for whatever reason that might entail, and we'll talk about some of the reasons that is. But by and large, there is a move underfoot across the state to go to PTO plans. You know, and not to bore you with the textbook definition, but generally speaking, PTO takes a number of leave banks and combines them into one. That's kind of a misnomer. Sometimes more than one leave bank, but essentially what happens is at the end of the day, you have less leave banks to administer than what you did before. That's right. There was a lightning storm going on or something. So when you look at that, I mean, what we're typically dealing with are the silos. And I like using an analogy of silos. You can use buckets. You can use whatever you want. But each one of those leave banks has its own individual sets of rules that do not necessarily provide the employee the flexibility that they need. I think every one of us who's ever dealt with personnel have found situations where the rules for a leave bank don't necessarily line up with the reason for the need for the time off, regardless of whether or not you want to grant that time off to that employee. And so PTO, sticking with the theme of silos, is you go to a bigger silo. and you try to lump those banks of time into each other. And so, again, at risk of using a very simple analogy there, it's trying to make things less from an administrative standpoint and give employees the flexibility to use that time in a manner that's best for them. But also looking at the reasons and some introductory thoughts. And this is a presentation, about an hour and a half presentation that I've whittled down to about 15, 20 minutes. So when you look at it, employees nowadays are, and this study after study has shown that one of the things, especially the newer generation of employees, aside from asking what am I going to be making for a living in terms of money, is how much time am I going to have off to spend with friends, family, or whatever. So when you bring in a newer generation of employees, having that flexibility with that time off, as well as the employees who are here already, who might have other needs for that time off. And I'll touch on one of my last bullet points here. But it's also, time off is part of the total compensation mix. It's a very expensive component of the total compensation mix. And I think I have a slide that will address that as well. The one size does not fit all is very important. If it did, you wouldn't have someone like me talking to you while PTO would be in place. It would just be nice, easy, let's move to it, let's get it done. But there are different factors that go into place, and there's probably 30 or more decision points that an organization needs to make to put a plan like this in place. And again, it depends on the organizational culture, the goals, the mindset, those sorts of things. I'm talking about the mindset. One of the things that you look at as a switch from PTO is, instead of being, I call it the leave bank czar, that if you don't meet these rules, sorry, you don't get your time off, you stop caring less about do they get the reasons for the time off and more can you get this time scheduled. And in this particular case, with PTO, and again, I think this is probably one of the biggest things, especially, and I know you don't have the pressure of a 24/7 operation that a lot of employers might have, but the absence management is crucial in terms of making sure that those leave banks are scheduled, those leave times are scheduled as opposed to unscheduled. The unscheduled absences have a tremendous pressure on an organization that I think most people don't realize, and I think we'll also touch on that in one of these next slides. So that's the introductory thoughts to these. But if you look at the CCH, and I wish I could tell you the exact, I think it's Consolidated Clearinghouse, but I could be wrong about that. But they ran a series of time-off studies. They did one in 1995, and then their last one was in 2007. The survey is now defunct, and it's a tragedy because they had really good data that was included in there. But the point of this is these two right here, personal needs and family issues and personal illness, accounted for 72% of the unscheduled absences back in 1995. Things such as stress, entitlement mentality, and personal needs made up the balance of it, the remaining 28%. You can see just in a 12-year time span that the entitlement mentality and the other categories are much harder to quantify. Usually you know when a personal illness exists, at least you think you know when a personal illness exists. That decreased, the family issues decreased, but the other ones really become much more difficult and I think show the trends as it relates to employees coming into the workplace and the needs for the time off. But again, those are just for the unscheduled absences, again, on a national basis. And you look at this, time off is an expensive benefit that we provide to employees. This is an oversimplified version of this. It doesn't include, when we start talking about dollars here, we're talking just wages. We're not talking any of the benefits that are rolled up into it. So if you have 100 employees, an average of 275 hours of paid leave per year, that's when you factor in, and again, I'm making some assumptions here, but when you fold in holidays, you fold in vacation time, you fold in sick time, you fold in bereavement leave, and some of those other leaves that come along with that. Well, so 275 hours of leave, 2,080 hours work, $25, you're looking at just under $700,000 in leave benefits alone. Or, when you look it out, and I did my other examples, or my prior version of this, it was a different number in here, but 13.2% of your workforce accounts for nothing but time off for employees. And wouldn't it be nice and neat if those 13.2 employees lined up where you could have them and plug them whenever you needed when someone was gone, but they're scattered throughout your organization. They're each individual employee. But again, when you look at this, you know, comparable to health insurance, comparable to pension, 13.2% of your employee base, so $700,000 is nothing to sneeze at in an organization, and I don't even know how large is Alloway in terms of number of employees.
There's
40 right now. Okay. So about 300, I'd say probably 300 to 350,000 probably is a probably comparable number for Alloway. What's not included, and you're talking about cost of a day off in terms of, we just talked about that, 600 for 100 employees, about $700,000. It also includes the roll-ups, which aren't factored into it. So when you say roll-ups, the pension costs, the FICA taxes, but it's also the replacement costs. What do you do when the employee's not there? So if Tracy's not here for a day, do you just let the pile stack up a little bit more, or do you replace her? You know, and again, in a 24/7 a sheriff's department or a police department, it becomes a much more serious issue. But the studies have shown that the replacement costs are about a 3-to-1 margin in terms of $3 for every $1 of payroll costs. Supervisor time trying to hunt somebody down, trying to manage that workload, trying to redistribute if you bring in temporary workers to cover those unscheduled absences. Lost revenue if they're revenue generation. And so again, looking at that, it's a very expensive proposition, and I don't think I think it goes without saying that unscheduled absences are the most costly of all absences. This is just an example of actually a prior. This was when we were in Calumet County, but in terms of the costing that goes on to help people understand the productive time versus non-productive time. So we work through, it's very similar to what we just saw in some of the previous slides, a little bit more detail. But one of the things I want to point out is, you run this all through, that the non-productive payroll is $1.5 million against the productive payroll. So for when employees are here, it's, you know, the amount of time that they have. So if you look, I'm sorry, let me just make sure I have here. Productive hours, 1,722 hours in a work year in this particular example, or where the employees are actually productive working for the employer. The other thing that's important is that this number grows, because most plans have a situation where you've been here 2 years, you get an additional week of vacation, those sorts of things. So when you see this costing takes into account that in the second year of this costing model, the average employee got about 7 hours more in PTO time. So it's an ever-changing benefit. One of the good news is, you know, in a recent example, we had a highway department where we lost about 15% of our workforce because of the Act 10 and a bunch of retirements. Well, they gained about 300 hours of productivity in a year with each employee because you had vacation time and sleep time being dropped off the books and people coming back. And so you saw a department that was able to gain much more productivity as a result of that, but that's a short-lived notion because over the course of time, employees begin earning that time off again. But the point of these last few slides is to illustrate that time off is a very expensive employee benefit and something that managing it is in everybody's best interest. And the question is, will PTO save money? I'll cut to the chase, and the answer is, I don't know. It depends on the particular situation of the employer. It depends on how aggressive the employer wants to be. But let's just look at one possible example. Again, let's use 100 employees. If you have 100 employees, one day of sick leave per month, $25 per hour, so the book value, because there is no cash value necessarily to a sick leave bank, unless it... But so that $240,000 represents the total amount of sick leave accrued for those employees per year. And then there's a study out there also that talks about the number of average unscheduled days per year per employee. I use the general number, 5.4. And so the unscheduled absence is $108,000. That's just some of the core assumptions we use just to illustrate this point. Moving forward from PTO or to PTO, there's one main decision point, and that is, dropping the number of sick days earned per year. Almost every PTO plan I've seen, whether it's private or public, the underpinning of the PTO plan is that you drop the number of sick days earned per year in exchange for granting the employees the flexibility to use all the time in a much more flexible manner. And so let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that you drop it by 2 days. So you drop it down from 96 to 80. The other numbers stay the same, except for that 240,000 goes down to 200,000. Also hoping that by encouraging employees to schedule that time off, you're still going to have employees who get sick at the last minute, a car breaks down, you have to run a child to the doctor, you're going to have unscheduled absences. I don't want to wave the white flag completely, but I think it's inhuman to think that you're not going to have those last minute situations where you just cannot plan for. But let's say you affect the number of unscheduled days per year. So you knock it down from 5.4 to 4 days per year per employee. So that $108,000 goes down to $80,000. So you have paper savings. And the reason why I say paper savings is because there are situations where you're granting employees more flexibility with that time off. Do they utilize time that they might not have otherwise utilized in the past? So you say this 80 hours gets built into our equation. In the past, you had to be sick, your child had to be sick, your spouse had to be sick, you had to qualify for family medical leave or military leave in certain situations in order to qualify for that sick leave. Now, under a PTO plan, you take away a lot of the rules and you say that 80 hours is open to you. So I don't want to sit here and sell you a bill of goods saying it's absolutely going to save you money, but some of the things in terms of the design will help cover the cost of increased utilization during the course of that year. In terms of decision points, and all of these are questions that we would walk through in the design of a plan, and I don't want to go through in each one in excruciating detail unless you do, but the point of it is, you know, what banks do you include? How do you deal with holidays inside of the PTO plan? The accrual, the amount, the method, you know, do you bi-weekly, monthly, annually, how do you set the caps, the multiplier, I call it the multiplier, how do you earn it? If you earn it on a monthly basis, do you do it based on number of hours worked? Sick leave, how do you deal with sick leave? Do you have a special account called an extended leave bank? Some organizations call it a catastrophic account. Again, it depends on the organization, how they want to approach it. What do you do with newly hired employees? Do you give them time to start off, or do you do something different? What do you do at the end of the year? Do you allow them to carry time forward? Do you cash it out? What decisions do you want to make with that? Do you allow them to share with each other? Do you allow them to donate back and forth? There's some legal and tax issues you need to make sure you cover yourselves with. What about employees who terminate? You know, do you pay them out? Do you set qualifications for that payout? Do you treat retirements differently? Attendance, do you make sure that you create policies within your PTO plan that encourage the scheduled absences and discourage the unscheduled absences? All of these hover around the issue of legality. You know, do you cover your bases in terms of family medical leave, fair labor standards, workers' comp? How does it interplay with other benefits? I can tell you that if you use the plan that I designed in Calumet County, your head will spin. We made it incredibly complex, but we were dealing with GASB 45 liability in terms of retiree health insurance, so we combined it with some other benefits. Do you want to go down that path? And I would recommend hit the pause button and say, yeah, I don't think you have the same issues we did just looking at your policies briefly as I did. There's also the transition plan. And the transition plan is, I don't say it's the easiest, but once you get all of these other things, everything else tends to fall in place. But this is just a sampling of the decision points that will be required to be brought to conclusion before a plan can be put in place. And every single organization I've seen has got a different approach to some of those. Some of them might be universal. You know, the standard out there right now for sick leave tends to be 1 day per month of sick leave. What the standard is in a PTO world is a whole different thing. There is no standard. And it's really, that's where discussion, bringing everyone to the table and making sure that everyone's on the same page. So that is the underlying mechanics. This is probably like the the biggest part of the workload and making sure that everybody's on the same page moving forward with the policy. But in terms of the proposed project, you know, it's divvied up into a number of different areas, but, you know, one is trying to understand on paper what you have now. There's no way we can get to the end unless we know what you have and be able to map it out and do a comparison and get that costed so we can explain to you, here's what it's costing you now, here's what it might cost you in the future as your employees gain more experience. Once you have that set in place, you're able to do it for when you have a proposed policy, what's it going to cost you and what might it save you, if anything. The discussions, I think, is probably the bulk of the work of getting those questions answered and making sure that you, the board, are on the same page as the administrative staff and the employees. And I don't know if it's necessarily always possible to get everybody on the same page on the way all the way through the organization, but at the end of the day, it ends with you. And then making sure that we draft a policy around the wishes of the board and that something meets the competitive needs of the organization. Getting it through the legislative process. Legislative process, obviously, is here as I'm talking tonight, is making sure that the questions you have are answered, that you know what's going on, and then ultimately getting the transition planning and the orientation process through orientation of the employees into the new plan. You know, again, no trying to figure out when you want that adopted, if it's a January 1st or something other than that. Talked about add-ons in terms of what might happen. If there's an in-depth analysis, you know, what we bring to the table is we have a pretty solid footing, but if it's a matter of that we want to know what villages the size of Alloway want, we want to have that, you know, either across the state of Wisconsin, which is pretty scarce, or across the nation. If it's additional data collection on top of that, we would look at it as an add-on. But we believe we bring enough of that to the table where we don't need to do any additional surveying for that. If you're looking at tying into other employee benefits, especially post-employment, and especially as it relates to post-employment health benefits, that's additional. A lot of employers are looking at that. That's why we put it out there, but we do know it's additional work. Often it will result in the work of, you know, legal. It may require, you know, in terms of other benefits consultants, which they would usually come in on a no-cost or low-cost basis. And some people have gone down the path of short-term disability or long-term disability to replace the sick leave benefit. We'll tell you right now that we are not short-term or long-term disability experts. We don't even pretend to be. We know what we know. We know what we don't know. And short-term disability is an area that you do need, if you do decide to go on that path, additional advice. And again, the network of consultants and brokers out there is pretty extensive that can walk people through that. It's not unchartered territory. It's just something that we aren't experts in. So we want to make sure that we're upfront when we start talking about that. So I tried to keep it short. I don't know if I've answered your questions. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Is there a magic number of employees at 48 or less than half of your example? Obviously, it depends on what all the benefits are, but
yeah,
I mean that our number seems kind of small.
Your number in terms of
employees, FTEs,
paid time off. I don't say it's a paid time off plan; it's a paid time off plan, but it's
right.
It really, a lot of it comes down to, is the organization ready for some of the mindset changes that come with PTO, whether it's 20 employees or whether it's, you know, 20,000, it really doesn't matter. It might be easier in some respects to implement it where you don't have layers upon layers upon layers of management and supervisory staff. But sometimes smaller is better. A lot of times.
Simpler.
I'm wondering about the first bullet point, because it strikes me that there are so many complexities to this, including what the current policy is, and if employees get paid out for sick leave accumulation at some point upon retirement, and we're not a 24/7 operation, but we're also pretty lean in terms of not having a lot of backup for certain people who are, you know, if they're serving customers and residents directly.
Mm-hmm.
So all these intricacies would, I think, play into whether or not we do this at all, and then kind of what it looks like. And I'm wondering, what isn't an add-on in terms of comparative analysis? Do you sort of just have a general feel of what people tend to do, or when does it become sort of a tailored design research study that would be an add-on?
If it goes beyond, you know, for example, we follow the trends in terms of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They publish data twice a year in terms of employee benefits. We follow that pretty closely. That it's not considered, you know, would be an add-on. SHRM and World at Work do pretty comprehensive studies. We don't consider that. Again, if you're looking at what is out there in the marketplace, generally speaking, but again, if you want us to go out and do a statewide survey or a multi-state survey, that is something that would be above and beyond the call of duty. But in terms of just the general best practices in workplaces in general, we have that material at our hands and we use it quite extensively.
Does the League of Municipalities, or is there any organization that collects
that's
data
why
routinely?
That's we at WPELRA 2 years ago, that's why we decided to take that up, because there was no data on a statewide basis. And so we, and that information I have because I created the survey back 2 years ago.
Are there any municipalities that are using PTO in Wisconsin, any that you're working with specifically?
No, and that's why we, normally the project this size, we would probably charge $200 to $2,500 more. And because this is the first project we've done for a municipality this size, we've kind of taken this as a, lack of a better term, a loss leader, that we know what we're doing, we know what we're doing in terms of this, but in terms of Alloway is the first one on the blocks for our organization. I've been with the company just under 2 months now. But there are any number of organizations who are either on the path or who have done so since that last survey. And they struggle with the same questions that were, you know, all of these bullet points, they struggle with all of those as they've gone through. I've fielded phone calls in my former professional life. It sounds like it's so long ago, and 2 months is a real long time, right? But, you know, we're organizations where my board wants to take us down to 2 sick days per year. You know, and what do you do with that? And again, it comes down to a cultural issue. And that's why that facilitation, making sure that we're kind of the intermediary between staff and the board, and making sure that we advise in terms of what's best practice and what's competitive and, you know, the overreaching or not reaching enough at times.
So we've made it our goal to have, well, actually we phrase it as a PTO system in place by January 1st. Mm-hmm. If we're going to do that, when do we need to make a decision as to whether or not we're actually going to go down this path and start through this process?
That is probably one of the instances where smaller is better. Because I think if you were an organization of 150, 200 employees, I think the lead time of 4 to 6 months is probably appropriate. I mean, now you're talking September.
Less than four.
Yeah. What's that?
Less than four, that would be.
Yeah. But I think in this particular instance that we would be able to hit the ground running enough and get the people on board. It depends on availability of everybody, obviously, but we could probably get this project where to the point of near completion by December 1, if we hit the ground running. I'm pretty confident that we could.
Trustee Zeller?
I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of your proposal that you provided.
Sure.
Tonight. Does anybody on the board have a copy of that?
This was given to you at your last meeting. There was an email that I have writing all over now, but this was given out to you that summarized what they would do and the cost for it.
Okay.
And this, I should have given you another copy of, but it was at your last meeting that we gave out to you.
The number was $5,400. $5,400
for the total engagement.
The total engagement
that included your bullet point list, but not the add-ons.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's inclusive
kind of
for where you are, including travel, including everything.
I'm in Chilton.
Chilton?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a question. You had said that there aren't any other communities that have PTO. You're saying that you have more specifically?
I have not worked with.
There are communities that have PTO, correct? There's,
yes.
I mean, Bellevue just put theirs in. I know Don Grafton has one. So there's a lot of communities that
have
them.
And they, a lot of them have evolved since Act 10 has been finally adopted. Or, I don't know if anything's final yet because it's still in the Supreme Court system. But. Okay.
Trustee Gingrich.
And our motivation or driving force has been what to get this going? Cost savings?
And ease of administration.
Ease of administration, too.
It is so much easier than the filings.
Okay. See, that's not a question. That wouldn't be a question for me. That would also
right,
be.
Just,
yeah. And we also talked about benefits to employees as well. To be able to, we have some systems here that nobody really likes, these green slips no one seems to really like, and I think that's part of the whole leave system, is that we have to fill out exactly why, you know, why we're taking leave and check the right box and make sure that you have enough hours accrued in that silo. And so administratively for us and in terms of employee flexibility, it's something that we can do explore.
It just seems archaic, the whole having to ask permission and provide details that are personal. The PTO seems to give employees much more latitude.
And you said that 12 is the average number of sick days?
That seems to be pretty universal. In the state of Wisconsin, in the public sector, in the private sector, the answer is no. It's not universal.
Right, yeah.
But in the public sector, I would say that's a truism, that it is about 12 per year. I've seen some with 14 or 15 per year, but it's usually right around one per month.
What's the average taken out of that 12?
You know, we did that analysis. I'll use Cuyahoga County as the example. When we did our PTO plan back in 2003, the average usage, I think, was 5.4. And that was including those who had long-term family medical leave absences, and then the vast majority who had zero or next to zero usage in an average year. But that's a pretty close number in terms of utilization. I'd say between 4 and 6 days. Some organizations that I've helped with PTO discussions in the past, we're averaging 8 or 9, and there's a huge motivation to get a PTO plan in place for the unscheduled absence component and management.
I'd imagine that the average probably differs depending on whether there's a rollover and a payout for sick leave, right?
Yes.
Trustee Zeller.
Just going back to the one topic, that long-term disability and short-term disability, I understand you're not an expert on that.
Right.
But typically, the long-term disability starts at 180 days, I think it is.
Generally speaking, yes.
Okay, but I'm not familiar with short-term disability. Is that like a 30-day or a 60-day?
And you can have shorter periods, that you give them PTO. And the shorter runoff period you have, the more expensive the policy gets.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there are very few. I think Brown County had some variation of a short-term disability plan. If they still have it, I don't know. But we had to reach out to other states when we were doing our research. Minnesota has a number of counties who had short-term disability, and the advice I got every time I talked to it, didn't matter which county, was be careful when you do it. And it wasn't that it was necessarily bad. You just want to make sure you don't design where you step all over yourself when doing it.
Mm-hmm. So, and we have the long-term disability policy in place. Is that right?
Yes.
At 180 days?
Yep. And okay. Then you can buy down if you want, but 180 is what the village provides.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just the agenda item is presentation, so we don't have an action item on this for tonight, right?
Right. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
I think it behooves us to have it on as an action item for the next meeting, and we're going to have to start to make some decisions as to whether we're going to explore this or not.
Maybe Patrick can give us a formal contract on it then?
Yes. So if you do have any questions, Tracy knows how to get a hold of me.
Thanks so much for coming.
Yep, thank you.
Appreciate it. I heard we missed you the first time. Right?
What's that?
We missed you the first time around?
I think so.
Weren't you here when the
fire?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
You're right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
I shortened the presentation too, so that's probably good.
Patrick, is this your flash drive?
Nope, that's your. That was it.
Mm-hmm. That's your
public appearances. Is there anyone who'd like to speak this evening?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Jim O'Rourke. I spoke last time on the historic preservation intensive survey. I was on the ad hoc committee that put together the research and supported the contractor that did the research and wrote the report that was just recently approved. My background was, my role in that project was I provided the Keystone database that the contractor used to evaluate all 5,000 residential properties in the village. So I was at the very, very start and played a key role in providing the data for the contractor.
Mr. Olick, I'm sorry to interrupt. Keystone database, what is that?
Keystone is that the foundation. There was a database that the tax assessor for the village of Alloway used to use. I had a copy of that from 2010, and then I added additional fields and provided analysis for the contractor to evaluate the different historical properties. So it was the municipal database from the assessor's data that had all of the property details on it. So there were 5,000 properties on there. We contracted with the contractor to do a survey of all 5,000 properties to determine whether they were potentially eligible to become certified historic resources. And they drove down every street, looked at every house, and made notes on less than 1,000 properties. So they only actually did a survey of 20% of the 5,000 properties. And that resulted in a poor survey, as I felt. In doing that survey, they then evaluated something that we call the Lombardi District, which they tweaked the data to create a historic district that does not meet federal guidelines and regulations. So there's a lot of discrepancies in there, and the ad hoc committee was not given a chance to go over the report before it was approved. It was sent electronically to everybody except for me, because they know that I was paying a lot of attention to it, and so I didn't even get a copy of the electronic copy before it was presented to the ad hoc committee. So there's a lot of questions on it, and I did mention to Steve that I did have some concerns, and that what I had suggested to Steve was that we find a way to hire an intern from the university to review this and write up a final report on that. And Steve said, well, I don't think that there's precedent for an intern, and that we would be hard-pressed to find funding to go ahead and do that. So I did take another look at our report that was just submitted, and actually the author, and I'm looking at page 7, is that the author of the report was actually an intern that was hired in May of 2003. So at the last minute, they hired an intern to actually write the report. The principal investigators did their own research, and then our historic society sent lots and lots of information, and the intern is one who actually wrote who authored the report, and that's on page 7. So there is precedent for having an intern write it. I would suggest that we have an intern from the university who's in the urban planning department somewhere, somebody that is disassociated currently with the program. I've also suggested that we do this as a second phase to the initial phase, and this is, we have verbiage that people have been using, initial survey versus intensive survey, and words and vocabulary are very important. And this has come through now as was pushed through as an initial survey, and I can accept that. And now what I'm suggesting is that we do phase 2 as the final report, and that would be in keeping with the way that Sheboygan did their report. Sheboygan did their report in 3 phases over 3 years by the same contractor. And one of the complaints that we had from our committee was that we didn't have enough time to review and get any input into this thing. So what's going to be coming up at the later point in this meeting is going to be a request to send a letter of intent to the village, to the state, for future funding for projects that we would like to see done. And included in that letter of intent, I would like to see funding for an intern to write up a final report on this project, and specifically on the Lombardi district, which I don't think complies with the guidelines by any means at all. And so I know this is very complicated, and people want to know, why are historic districts important? And a well-run historic district creates a lot of value for a community. A poorly run historic district is a detriment. And so there's a lot of studies out there that have shown that, and we're working on our TIF districts and our TID districts with smart growth planning and everything. I've done a lot of research on our commercial districts with regards to the historic aspects of it, and because we got sidetracked very early in this procedure, the resources that should have been generated towards the proper historic districts got diverted, and they spent a lot of time concentrating on the Packer story instead of on the legitimate historic districts that we did have that would bring economic value and growth to our community. And I'm available later on in the presentation if you have any questions, but I just thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. Just one point of clarification. I didn't say there wasn't a precedent for using interns.
Oh, you just asked me.
We use interns quite successfully.
On this particular, whether the state would recognize the credentials of an intern.
Right, and that's, yeah, okay. That's what my main concern is, that if we were to hire an intern, who would supervise? I mean, the interns are usually very good at doing a lot of the legwork, mm-hmm. but under the supervision of someone who really knows the work. We don't have anyone here, and what we're trying to do is second guess or supersede the opinion of the state organization that does this as part of their mission. So I'm a little bit uncomfortable saying, let's get an intern, and we don't know who's going to supervise the intern, have them do a final report that may very well, if you're correct, be completely inconsistent with what the experts have told us to be the truth.
Correct.
I'm not sure I'm not sure who would do the supervising, and Sheboygan, I think, hired an intern as part.
No. Sheboygan hired the same contractor we did.
Okay.
We hired our contractor.
They hired the intern, though, but the intern was supervised by people who do this for a living.
We contracted with the contractor to write the report. She then hired an intern to write it for her because she had done all the research, and she turned everything over to the intern.
Right.
And my suggestion was that you use somebody in an urban planning environment, somebody outside of because my concern is that the top people in the organization for the Historical Society have messed with our survey, and that they've put a lot of pressure on people to get the Packer story told to the detriment of the legitimate historic districts. Now, the maximum value for a home in the historic district is tax rebates of $10,000 per year per property. So it's substantial. And so that there's a real benefit to the people, for example, a expensive tuck pointing and painting a very large home can be very expensive. And if you spend $40,000 to redo the exterior of your home and put in a new furnace, the state sends you a check for $10,000. So there's real incentives to have control over that process. And so my concern was I identified 7 houses in the Lombardi district, and the rules have been tweaked to say that as long as you live next to the Lombardi house, you don't have to follow the federal rules. And that's not right.
Okay, I'm not sure if that's true or not. I just wanted to clarify my concern.
And I provided
concern
that,
is that What you're proposing is that we hire an intern to do this work on his or her own.
I'm proposing that you request in the letter of intent that's going to go out next month or later on this month, you request from the Historic Society that we do fact-checking and verify that this report was done correctly. And that'll raise some eyebrows and it'll make people upset. And I've been told that we will never get funding again from the state if we question them. And that's a risk that we have to take because the integrity of the report trumps personal agendas.
I would agree. Thank you. Trustee Genridge.
In the event, as I recall, that there were three historic districts, Miramar, Sutton, Lombardi area over there, and a third one. If your example of the Lombardi neighborhood doesn't meet the federal, will that get kicked back, kicked out, redirected?
The term that was used was rubber stamp, and the federal government does not question the integrity of the state officers. So if the state officers say that it complies, it complies. The answer was, of the three districts, the correct names would be the Lombardi District, the Lambeau District, and the Astor District. So they spent a lot of time researching the Curly Lambeau House and the Don Hudson House. They spent a lot of time researching the Vince Lombardi House, and that took away from our budget of researching proper houses in other neighborhoods. So there were 12 districts, and 8 of them, and only 3 were approved, so that there was 9 rejected, which was unprecedented. This contractor had never had 9 districts rejected before. That's an 80% failure rate. The contractor never had an 80% failure rate before this time.
Why would the state be motivated to reject at 80% rate so that they wouldn't have to kick in if all the districts were established, and that would mean lots and lots of state money having to go to the village?
Yeah, it can become a very expensive it can become a very expensive program if everybody who meets the requirements actually gets in. So it can become very expensive. It's like everybody taking all their paid time off. I mean, it becomes very expensive. And that there was a personal agenda. Clearly, there was a motivation to support the Panther story and being on the Heritage Trail. We love the Heritage Trail. We love the Panther story. But only those particular houses get to be on the historic register. You don't get the whole neighborhood. So we like the Lombardi story. We love all of our Panther stories from the 1930s through the 1960s. Amway was the place to be if you were a Packer. And you know, now it's something else. But we have these historic homes and these historic districts that transcend just the Packer story. We like the Packer story, but that's not for everybody's neighborhood.
So, Jim, are you saying that the other houses in there, there's no real district? It's about a house?
It's about a house. So, statistically, and I said this at our meeting, at our preservation meeting, is that it would take 18 minutes to evaluate the Lombardi district, and for anybody who can do math, and do third grade math, they would know that those houses do not qualify. And in order to qualify, your house has to be older than 50 years old. So the house on the right doesn't qualify. That was built in the 70s. The house across the street doesn't qualify. That was built in the 80s and has vinyl siding. The house on the left had a major modification with a sunroom put on the front, an addition put on the garage, and that was given a waiver, and that was built in the 30s. So I looked at all of them. I color-coded them. I presented them, and I got overridden. And so that's why I have no motivation here. There's no money in history. This is my hobby. I like history, and I like Galilee, and I wanted to pull together a great story for my kids so that they have deep roots and document the story of Galilee. And that was my motivation. and we were invited to participate and bring our expertise. We were already 3 years into our research project when this came up, and we were more than happy to share our data. And I had the actual physical data that would be able to tie together the value of a house and the value of being in a historic district and be able to quantify that for future studies. So we have all that. We have the best data available in the country for starting an intensive survey, and it's been tainted.
Can you just give us an example of what district we might be missing out on by? It's my understanding we can have three districts, right?
No, you can have the entire village. This is something that I discovered in, because I read all the reports. I'm kind of odd. I like to read government reports. And the National Park Service has some of the smartest people in the country working on this. My degree was from the university and this stuff. So about 10 years ago, the National Park Service said there's something called a historic suburb. And a historic suburb would be one that developed along the trolley lines and had cluster housing and had moderate-type housing and a variety of housing issues. And as I'm reading this report that was put out by the National Park Service for this particular intensive survey process, I'm saying, that's exactly the way that Alloway developed. And then I said, we don't have a central core. We developed as a trolley suburb starting in the 1890s. Originally, where the reformatory was, that was going to be a new industrial site in the 1890s, following the Chicago World's Fair. Investors from Green Bay and De Pere got together, they bought up the Leeball Farm, and they bought up all the farms, and we're going to start building bicycle and windmill factories. That foundation got laid, they went broke. The owners of the property applied to the state and said that they wanted to build a prison there instead. The state said, okay. They looked around and said, that's the best spot for a prison. And then the other investors in there, Green and Roman, redivided the land that they were going to originally build the city of Alloway and decided to keep it a town and make it a suburb. And that's what they did. They bought in the trolley lines and they redeveloped it, and that's where you ended up with the Murphy Coles estate, and you ended up with all of the nicer, larger homes, and then you ended up with the smaller trolley homes along the trolley lines. And that was all I spotted this in the National Park Service manual on historic suburbs, and that's it describes Alloway to it perfectly to the T, and it's probably one of the best examples in the country of how it would work.
So the whole village would be of historical significance?
5,000 houses.
So you're saying there, out of the 8 that were rejected or whatever, we're not talking about there are 1 or 2 in there that should be in the Lombardi district, is it? We're talking, your idea is that the whole village of Alloway would be a historic place of historical significance. Or
that's taking it to the extreme, and I looked at that and I said, well, the Park de Langlade is a newer subdivision, so we don't meet that criteria yet. But in order to make the Lombardi district fit, they jumped into the Park de Langlade and started picking out samples in Park de Langlade that fit the house next door to the Lombardi house to say, see, this is a good example of a historic home. And all of a sudden they started using homes from the 70s as good examples of historic homes. And that raised some eyebrows for me. So,
did you have something interesting?
I was just wondering if what we should do is move our agenda item 12 up, possibly to after our old business, after 7, so that we could have this discussion and open up the meeting to Jim at that point.
Sure, you can do that.
Yeah, and so my point is that I'm trying to leave the residential stuff alone. My real interest is in developing the commercial corridors that we have along the river and in our TIF districts and along the trolley lines and understanding how smart growth works, and that's where we have some impact. The residential, the homes, people can take care of their own personal homes, but the real impact would come in the commercial business districts and in the TIF districts.
Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to speak this evening? Hearing none, we'll move on to item six. Actually, is there a motion to...
I move to move agenda item 12 to 7B.
Is there a second? Trustee Green seconds. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Item 6, action regarding updating ordinance 11.03, definition of home occupation. I can hear from Mr. Robert first. He should be relatively familiar with this. Marco?
This was brought up at our last meeting. The definition of home occupation, home occupation definition that I brought up from LSU. That I thought maybe we adopted into our ordinance here. So our definition is very, it says four lines, very vague. We want to brought over, it's a little bit more detailed and explaining, because actually trying to do a home occupation, find somebody doing a home occupation is a little bit harder. I mean, you know where they are, but you need criteria to identify it other than just saying that, you know, members of a household are the only ones allowed to do that. And that no special space is used for business, and they can only sell products from made in the home. This details it where you can't have signs, like the gentleman up on the Brun had a open business sign in his window. Can't stockpile stuff in the house to sell. But this also has other things like identify where somebody like Mary Kay, you can use the Mary Kay. Our definition right now doesn't even allow somebody to use the Mary Kay in the house. This would allow somebody, you know, selling outside the home to bring the product in. Somebody can stop by and pick it up, as long as you're not bringing in an inordinate amount of traffic. Also, does not allow oversized vehicles, other than, you know, UPS trucks, and just keep coming in and out of the neighborhoods, disrupting the neighborhood than normal. The other thing I like, we had on ours only says is provide for family members. We've got a lot of duplexes here where you've had two roommates, two females that want to sell something, or, you know, so we were not allowing other people that just said family would only want. Well, you might have, like I said, you might have roommates wanting to do a home occupation, not a home occupation. Meeting criteria for home occupation, we weren't allowing that. The other thing I looked at the bottom, the difference was our garage sales. We allow three garage sales every quarter, so you can do it any 3 days, so 12 days a year we allow garage sales, but it's only 3 days a quarter. But it's broken up, so you can have as many garage sales as you want for that quarter. The way we do it at Ledgeview, which that would depend on how y'all look at it, is we only allow two a year for 72 hours straight. We don't allow you to break it down and come in Friday, do a yard sale, not on Saturday, and do it on Sunday. Whereas here, we do. You can do 3 days. I don't know if that makes any difference. We do have a lot of garage sales here. And, but that breaks down, it's not really a home occupation, but I've actually, I think two people I've written that have exceeded it, and almost where they were running a business out of their homes as a garage sale, covered as a garage sale. That helped, cadets helped with that a lot, writing down every time they see a garage sale. So this covers that also. Instead of having it separate, would be up in here. I just felt it gives me a little bit more power to look for somebody if they're running a business out of home. Also, this says you can't have signs in the yard, you can't change the outside appearance of the house, you can't say outside appearance of the yard. It just gives me a lot more definitions of what is allowed and not allowed.
Would it be simpler to have just one per quarter? You can have a garage sale not longer than 3 days in length per quarter. Most people do Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or something like that.
Most people do, but the ones I caught before were doing them like all 3 days, and then I'm sitting there catching them about 2 weeks later doing it again.
But the way that you first described it, it sounds like you could have a one-day garage sale on a Saturday, and then the next weekend have another one-day garage sale on a Saturday, and then
that's
the next weekend have another one.
Right,
on
that's why the ordinance is in it. And it does make that difficult to keep up with them because the debts aren't here all the time.
And that's what I'm wondering. If it's just one per quarter, maximum length of 3 days, then the cadets would just have to keep track that so-and-so had a garage sale this quarter, and they wouldn't have to constantly be monitoring whether or not the next weekend they came in and had another 1 day, how long the garage sale lasted, and whether, you know, keeping tallies of actual days, they would just need occurrences.
Agreed.
Where is the stipulation about the frequency? Where's the garage sale?
Q.
Q? Last one, okay. Twice per year. Mark, what do you, I know you talked about stockpiling, and there's in, is it L that it talks about racks and shelving, and how do you know if someone's, I don't really know what stockpile and inventory really means?
You really don't know unless you've seen it. I mean, it's, again, the only person I've seen do it was the gentleman that was running the bicycle business. I think when I drove by that time, he had the bikes racked up in the ceiling, and it was just like a, you go to any other bike store, you had probably about 30, 40 bikes in there. But I just saw that. Stockpiling to me would be if somebody had it in the garage, and that'd be about the only time you'd see it unless I went to a house or if one of the officers went to a house and saw somebody sell a bunch of stuff out of the house. That's, again, that's hard to find. But if you had
somebody. Is that really what we want to do? We want to prevent people from keeping merchandise and parts at their house? If someone has a bike shop, they might very well have lots of parts laying around their house that they take to and from their shop or maybe work at home. So do we want to prevent them from having inventory at their house? What we really want to prevent is people coming over to their house and buying things, right? And having them run a business and there be transactions, face-to-face transactions out of someone's home.
But if we have the, is it, you know, that is direct sales products on display shelves, racks, is not allowed. So when we come in and do a direct sales, plus we have the one in there not changing the flow of the traffic. We have so much traffic coming in, if it gets noticeable, that would bring, you know, of course, a red flag up. But you don't want to stop exactly, like I said, Mary Kay or Avon.
Right.
And if they're having a couple people in and out here and there, that's not what we're after.
Right. It would be something that would be noticeable. Somebody would, again, like, I have the Dawkins over there on Taft Street. I never saw it until somebody finally complained, said that people are dropping their dogs off in the morning, picking their dogs off at night. And I would never see it until somebody complained, because it's in the morning, real early, then coming in and late at night, picking up the dogs.
You mentioned inventory or stockpiling. Is it C that you were referring to? Storage of goods, materials, or products connected with a home occupation. So, maybe if I can't understand this, I'm not sure that. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I'm hoping that this is clear to people who want to do stuff, have materials from their business at their house. And is that clear in here that you can have materials? If you have a bike shop, you can take wheels and things home and work at them in your basement. You can have a basement full of parts. You can have a garage full of parts on the shelves of your garage. Is that correct, or is that not allowed?
That would be as long as you're not bringing people in there to buy those parts, or they're taking the parts. If you're using your own parts, that's fine. That certifies under home occupation. If you're in a garage, work on a bicycle, that's fine. You take the bike out to get somebody, somebody picks up the bike, that's fine. As long as somebody's not coming in, you're selling parts to that person to fix their own bike, then you're running home occupation if you're being like the salesman.
So if it's retail, is that what?
Basically, if you're running a retail out of your own home, the only ones you can run a retail basically is like I said, a Mary Kay, something simple like that, or if you're building a birdhouse, but you're not building mass quantities of, you know, thousands of birdhouses and some boxes of them coming out, that would make it, that would make a home occupation where you're selling retail out of the house. Basically, home occupation is supposed to be something simple that doesn't disrupt the neighborhood.
I get it conceptually. I'm just not sure that I would know where to draw the line here. I know you've added lots of details, and you've got more guidelines than we did before with the really brief, you know, three-sentence ordinance, but I'm still not sure. Did you say someone could come over and pick up their bike from your house? Is that
right? It's like if you, you keep using Mary Kay because that's a simple one where, you know, they go out to a home and have a Mary Kay party. She makes the sales, and she can either take the product that she's going to get from Mary Kay to keep in her house, but she's going to get rid of it usually immediately. And she can take it out, or a person might say, come home after work and pick it up. But they're not really just, you know, hundreds of people coming in your house picking up a product.
So why can't the bike guy have people pick up their bikes from his house?
Something like that.
Drop them off at his house.
They can drop them off, pick them up, as long as it's just... You just want to have so much people disrupt it. If they started bringing attention to themselves, that they're bringing so many in, that'd be the difference. I know you can't have an exact science on everything we do.
I know, but we need to get some guidelines. I mean, I'm just thinking about the bike guy, and I'm not sure whether he's in or out under this. And so one of the things we're talking about is retail. A retail operation, you can't have, you know, shelves and have people come in, and the bell rings when you open the door, and there's a new customer, and you've got your cash machine and all. I get that, but then we sort of change the criteria to it's the amount of traffic now. You can kind of do retail as long as you only get one person a month in that comes in to drop their bike off or pick their bike up. So I'm not sure.
Well, that's not really retail because he's not selling. He's selling his what he's fixing, but he's not selling. Okay, I'm going to sell you the part. Like I said, the guy comes in there and coming in to buy all the bike parts from him. Say,
so if it's a service, then it's exempt?
That would be, in my opinion, actually a service, as long as you're just not bringing in.
So if we have someone giving massages in their house and people come to their house, there are five people a day? See, we're using two different standards. We're using, well, it can't be where you're actually selling something in your house, and then, well, you can sell something, but it has to be a service. But no, it's based on the amount of traffic. I'm not sure we can use all three of those and then just sort of decide on a case-to-case basis. And I know it's not easy. We had the same problem with this trailer thing. We went on for years because we're trying to sort of legislate something that's not really very easy to legislate. But, we have more details, but I'm still not certain if I get a call from the bike guy or from someone else saying, hey, can I do this? I wouldn't know what to tell them based on what we have. So you might, but shouldn't we be writing things that we all kind of understand and we know, including residents, they know what the rules are? Otherwise, we're going to have the same arguments as we're having now.
Could we just look at this and decide which ones we know would make sense and then try to clarify the other ones? I mean, at least so we have some basis. Like, we know we don't want any advertising signs.
Right.
You know, so maybe just look and say G's good, H is good.
Yeah, we can do that.
Well, you know, don't take away to look at it a little bit more, you know, get an idea of what you think it should or should not be in there. It is pretty detailed. And again, I've been doing this for a while, so I know what I'm looking for. I guess this is kind of hard. I already know what I'm looking for. I'm looking for home occupation. And again, the reason I brought a couple of these was because of Kimmel. They're advertising. That's one other thing. They're advertising on the website and the news and the phone book, and they have signs on the door. So that's
right. And I think that's
what
you're
pretty clear.
There are certain things that we know. You don't want you advertising.
Right.
On-site advertising.
We don't have that in this, or all the work I'm saying you could do that.
Right.
So they can advertise whatever they want to. That's what they were doing.
Like I said, I know this is difficult, and I'm not saying you didn't do some good work here. I just don't think we're all the way there yet, because I think we need to get to a point where not only do you know what you're looking for, and I think I do. I think I'd know home occupation when I saw it, but I might not agree with you. We need to write ordinances that were pretty clear what, you know, it's kind of like art. There, we all know good art when we see it, but there are also standards that you can use to evaluate art. And mainly for residents. I mean, residents need to know, yeah, I thought you'd be coming to visit me someday, Mark, because this is pretty clear, and I know I was doing something wrong. Yes. Or not.
And I understand.
It's fuzzy. Some of it's fuzzy. But a lot of ordinances are kind of fuzzy.
I know.
Could I suggest this, that we, first a question, Debbie, on an ordinance, if an ordinance is approved, then it requires a second reading. Is that right?
No,
it does not. Okay. So the ordinance would only require approval by the majority of the board?
Okay. Correct.
Okay.
And then it would have to be published. It would go into effect once it's published.
All right. Could I suggest that we change Q to read that that there would be four garage sales allowed per year?
Would that be one per quarter, or could you have four and four consecutive weekends? Or one and four consecutive weekends?
I wouldn't necessarily limit it to quarterly. Do we have problems with repeat garage sales on a weekly basis? Do we have any?
There are a lot. There's only two that I've actually identified since I've been here, because again, it's difficult the way it's written. It's almost like they can just have them whenever they want to now, and so they can only have three per quarter, but it's not consecutive. They could have one today, 2 weeks from now have one, and then 3 weeks from there have another one. So it's almost impossible trying to keep up with them. But we did actually identify a couple of people that were running them like every weekend, and we called them. But that's, you know, anybody else could be doing that. It's almost impossible to catch, because we've got it set up where you could have three every 3 months. They could actually do four, and I wouldn't notice it, because you don't catch them all the time. If they have them all on the weekends, I'm not here.
Okay, so for discussion purposes, let's go with Q being four, but one per quarter. And then for this being brought back to us at our next meeting, if we could, if you could come up with some language on that retail prohibition, that we could discuss, and then we could postpone to our next meeting for this.
New language for which one?
Q.
For C.
C.
For the retail prohibition.
The new inventory for sale. If that could be cleared up a bit in the language that you would feel would be effective, and then. Because I don't think we're going to solve it tonight, that we would have a revised document for 2 weeks from tonight.
So can we give Mark a sense of what we want? Well, I think we did this last time, but what we want. Do we want to allow the bike guy to have people over to his house to pick up his bike after he works on it?
For service. Because as I understand it, that the infraction was the sale of new product there.
And then he had a showroom and...
Right, he had, when everybody was selling new bikes out of the garage, and plus he had a sign, you know,
the sign
business.
Yeah.
That
yes.
Went by, there were cars just lined up in the street.
Yeah. So, now, we still may have cars lined up in the street for service, if we allow the service, but I don't see that as much of a problem as the retail storefront type problem.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with the service, and the providing of the service worked out fine. Just in my observation on the corner of Libel and on Broadview, yes, Libel and Broadview, through the years that didn't seem to be just disruptive to the neighborhood for the service that she was providing. So,
yeah, I think we need to focus on what Mark mentioned first before we get into all these other, whether it's a product, whether it's a service, because I think we have to focus on the intensity of traffic. And because, like I said, there are lots of services that I can imagine where you're not actually selling a product. There's a massage parlor. I mean, you could have people in and out of the house 4 or 5 a day, right? So, or, yeah. Yeah, hair salon, right? Or, and, you know, that's...
But keep in mind, we have people who aren't even running businesses who have 4 to 5 people out of their house a day.
Sure.
So... Yeah, quantifying that traffic.
It could be 10 or 20, or I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking about the neighbor who said, look, I moved in here, and all of a sudden...
Right. It's the disruptive traffic that's the problem.
Right.
How about this? If the resident wanted to provide a service, a business that would be a service-based business, that they be allowed to apply for a conditional use permit. But it would be otherwise excluded or prohibited in the new ordinance.
Where would
I'd say that's open in a can of worms.
Those dogs would be a service. Isn't that providing a service? Take dog care.
But they would be subject to the approval of the board to provide the operate the business.
Yeah, but we don't allow operation of kennels in the village, period.
But I mean, then, now you're looking at, you know, okay, I want to do a bicycle thing over here, okay? You don't let me open a bicycle little shop. I'm doing that. My neighbor goes, oh, I want to open this business. And you're like, no, you can't open that one. Let's see, you're opening a can of worms for that. Look at somebody saying, it's almost like the good old boy system. I like you. You can have it. You can't.
Okay, if that's the case, then we need to tighten this up to prevent services and retail operations
that are disruptive, not just prevent.
That's
all.
What I think. That we have to focus on the,
yeah.
The disruptive part is what would have to be.
That's right.
Clarified.
That's
then.
Why I said
what,
we need
how
to,
do we say
need
that?
To focus on that instead of the service versus retail product. I think.
Well, that's the listing of the different items really focuses on the disruptive part of it. It's not
right.
Focusing on what they're doing. It's saying these are things that would be typical if you are running your business out of your home, and we don't want these kind of things going on in our residential communities. So that's what this list really is focusing on, that more than per se what they're doing, you know, in the home, mm-hmm. whether it's a service or a product or whatever. It's saying if these things are occurring, there's an issue with what's going on at your home, and that would prohibit you from doing what you're doing.
Okay, I'm not clear on that then. Tracy, you're saying that this is enough of a blanket for Mark to be effective, that this, as it is this is from Ledgeview?
This is Ledgeview's, and I think a lot of these things are just putting some answers to what defines a home occupation that could be disruptive to a community or to a residential neighborhood. And, you know, all these things listed on here are same things that people may complain about. Oh, you know, there's tons, we have advertising signs, there's tons of cars coming in the community. And those are things that someone would call on. So I think the list here is more trying to say this is what would give you a home occupation that's a problem. And if these things are occurring, then the village is going to say, you can't have that there. And you're getting away from saying, okay, is it a service, is it a product, or what are you doing? It's really looking at the negative product that could come out of a home occupation and really ruling on those, or not curtailing, but really using those as a criteria to judge whether that home occupation could be there or not.
Okay.
So it's looking at the opposite of what you guys are looking at right now in a certain review with this listing.
So does the person have to meet all these criteria in order for it to be a home occupation?
Basically, it's the other way. It's if any of these are happening. Any of these are happening.
Even one of those.
That's making it a home occupation, which they can't be doing. Actually, it's kind of weird. A home occupation is actually something you do. This would be the part of saying that you are operating a business, not home occupation. You are operating a business. Home occupation is just a simple thing of what you're doing. This, all this, if you're doing this, you're running a business. You're not running a home occupation. Okay. Home occupation is supposed to be just something simple that somebody does to make ends meet. Some people may make a living off of it. You know, like I said, Mary Kay, that's, you know, some people do a full-time job, but a guy building a birdhouse, something like this. But if you're doing this, now you're running a complete business. You're not running a home occupation.
Okay, maybe we need to clarify that. I mean, basically what we're trying to determine is which bucket do you belong in,
right?
Home occupation, or are you running a business?
Right.
And someone should be able to look at this and say, oh, I belong in that bucket.
If you're doing
bucket.
Any of this,
and
you're
right now,
running a business.
I can't tell.
Right.
I can't tell from the way it's written. Again, using the bike guys case, I can't tell which bucket I would put him in.
I put him in the business bucket.
I would too. But then when is he not in that bucket? If he takes the signs down, is he not in that bucket? If he, when did we get him out of that bucket and into the other bucket? And what does he have to do? And that's
probably
what's not clear to me.
Probably exceeding 20% of his total floor area if he had that many bikes.
Okay, so if he fixes that, then... you know,
well, what the ours is that if you use 20% of the flooring for business, take that out and go back to the old one where you can't use any of your...
actually, he's not
no special kid. Space is needed to create something.
He's not exceeding 20% of the total floor area of his house. His garage, maybe, but not his house.
Right.
It does sound like he has disruptive traffic, though.
Yeah, I know.
That's
what coming back to.
So, you know, if you look at age, you get one car more than normal and you're disruptive.
What's that?
Age says a home occupation shall not create greater vehicle or pedestrian traffic than normal. Well, if you've got one or two coming in to pick up a used bike, that's more than most people wouldn't be coming there if you didn't have a business.
See, and that's where I disagree with it, because people have parties all the time with more than one or two.
But
so
that's what this says.
Or friends over for a card game in the evening with more than one or two. So, yeah.
Okay.
Trustee
Miller's right. We're not going to solve this tonight. Yeah. I have a feeling this is going to go on a little while. And this is even more important than parks and trails.
I was going to say, it's reminding me of both of
them. People's livelihoods are going to depend on this, and we need to get it right to make sure that we're all understanding and we're sending consistent messages. And I don't think we are with this. And it's no fault of your own. It's complicated, and it's not easily solvable. So... I'll entertain a motion. Trustee Zeller, did you have one that you wanted to do?
I was thinking that I could start a trailer parking business and we could see how Mark handles
that. Is that a service? It is a service.
So I would move to postpone to our next meeting with another version, knowing that it may not be perfect, but just another version, Mark, in 2 weeks. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, okay.
I'm still feeling the need to give Mark. I mean, we talked about how this is confusing and it's not perfectly evident where someone, like, pick anybody, has a business running from their home, an Avon person, or where they would belong according to this. But beyond that, I'm not sure we've given Mark much direction as to what kinds of things we want to consider a business versus home occupancy. And it sounds like, if we just take some examples, the Avon person, that's fine, right? At least traditionally the way they've been run, it's fine. Every month or two, you have a little get-together and you are pampered chef, right? The bike guy, it sounds like the way that he's doing, if it weren't for the signs and all those sorts of things, yeah, let the guy fix bikes and have people come and pick up their bikes from his house. That seems fine. So is that the sense that I'm getting from the board, so that when Mark goes to create the definition for these two categories, home occupancy versus running a business, he sort of knows what types of things should fall into each. Is that kind of where the board is landing? Okay, and what sorts of businesses entities would you like to see in the business bucket? Something like someone who gives massages on a routine basis. Is that okay or not okay? Or
I'd say
someone
that's okay. That's not generating any more traffic than bike repair.
Okay. Someone who's selling stuff out of their house, retail, that's clearly a business.
Yeah.
Is that what we're talking about?
The way I look at it, anything you need retail, anything being sold out of the house. Again, you're looking at
I'm just trying to get what the boards, where the board's going with this, Mark, so that you know what words and what rules to put where. You can give your opinion about whether or not you think of something should belong in which category when we vote on it. Yeah.
So to be direct to the language here, I would ask you to revise C, mm-hmm. eliminate H, and revise Q.
I would ask you not to revise, not to eliminate H. I mean, let's leave it in there, and then when we vote on it, if we decide there's just no way to really define this, like Trustee Gendron said, there's what's more than normal, and there's no way we can really get it, we can throw it out then, but I just want to make sure that it's in front of us at the next version so we can at least consider whether or not it's feasible to have such a criterion.
It shouldn't be any more restrictive than what people are already doing at their houses.
Except for the ones that have signs.
Well, yeah, the whole signs in that one, I mean, the whole retail thing, yeah, is definitely out. What I'm worried about is, you know, the part of trying to put car numbers on it, you know, if you have four cars there, is that disruptive? If you only have one at a time, but there's three in a day coming and going, is that disruptive? It's like, I see what you mean about some of it's fuzzy and we need to put some stuff with it, but I really have a problem with ordinances that go outlawing stuff people are doing that's not disruptive at all. So I think we just need to be careful with H regarding that. Well, I agree it shouldn't be eliminated, but, man, do we need to watch the wording in there?
Right. But we also need to get it right because otherwise it could get out of hand. If someone wants to open a yoga studio in their garage and they have five yoga classes a day, and they've got 10 people per, and there's a neighbor that said, hey, I thought I moved into next to a residence and not a...
I've actually seen another ordinance written where you could have no more than one customer at a time. You know, and that was severely... just one. And, you know, that's not disruptive. How do you know that's not a girlfriend coming over for lunch? I mean, it just...
Right. Yeah, something like that. Okay. Sorry, Mark. Does that help?
Yes.
Trustee Zeller, did you have a motion? Did you?
I moved to postpone to.
Oh yeah, I was trying to second that when I had my hand.
Did we second it yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
I'll do that.
Actually, I propose to not eliminate H. Can I?
Sure.
Is that part of the explanation?
As well.
Okay. So is that okay with you, Trustee Green? We're not eliminating H. Okay. Further discussion. Anyone wants to talk about boats and trailers? All right. Okay. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Item 7, action regarding adopting ordinance 2013-10, keeping animals. Is there a motion with regard to this item, or do we want to hear from Mark and Trustee Green?
I'd move to adopt.
Is there a second?
A second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Old item 12, discussion on National Historic Register listing for municipal properties. Tracy.
Okay, this was discussed at our last Historic Preservation Committee meeting, which was last Wednesday. And what the committee would like to do is submit a letter of intent for the next round of state grants. And they voted on going ahead with this and submitting the letter of intent. And the letter of intent they would like to put in is to take the two municipal buildings, which is the community center and the water utility building on Green Avenue, or the two that were listed in our intensive survey as eligible for a National Historic Register place. The committee did vote on that and wanted to go ahead and submit a letter of intent for that project. They did discuss some other projects and some other things that came up, but they felt that this was the best way for them to start. It's a smaller project. it's municipal projects rather than a private home or a district to take on at this point. They did not feel comfortable going that far at this point and felt that this was a good way for them to get their feet wet, learn what the process is to register or to try to get a facility put onto the National Register of Historic Places. So that was their motion, and that's what they voted to go ahead with. The letter of intent is due mid-September, and then the grant itself is due in November. So the letter of intent is just a way to get our foot in the door and say, yeah, we're interested in doing it, and then they would get back to us and say, yeah, it looks like a viable project. Go ahead and continue on with the grant process. So the village board would have time to come back and look at it prior to that November final submittal if you decide that you want to go different route or not go ahead with the project. Again, it would be 100% funded, and what would happen is that we would hire, again, a consultant to do the national application for those two facilities, and they would do all the background and get the information together, and then they would submit it to the state and then onto the national for the historic register. The one thing that we wanted to go with the board by the board on was what that means to have a municipal building that is on historic register. And I did put a document together after talking to Chip Brown, who's the government assistant and training specialist for the Wisconsin Historic Society, who really is the one that does a lot of the National Register work for the state. Basically, once a municipal property is listed on the National Register, there are just some steps that have to be followed if you decide you're going to do anything with it, do any work on it. If the village should decide that they were going to raise that property for some reason, there's steps that need to be taken through the Wisconsin Historical Society staff before that work can be done. And you would just need to tell them what you're looking at doing. They may come in and say, well, can you do it in a slightly different way so that the historical integrity is kept on that facility. You talk about it. If there's no other way that could be done, the state would create a document stating the adverse effect will happen, and they would go on. You would go on and be able to do the project. The state cannot veto or they cannot deny any work to be done. They also cannot deny the raising of that building. But the municipality would just be required to go through a process if you want to do any work or do any demolition of a national registered facility. The village would not get any tax credits, obviously, because we are tax exempt. So we won't get any tax credits on any work that we would do. But talking to Chip, there are other funding sources out there, maybe federal money through HUD, he said may be available. Or there's some private foundations that are set up that really what the funding sources are for this type of work. So he said there are other options out there for the municipality to look at. The other part of what he mentioned is if the village decides to sell the property, so a private individual buys it or a company buys it, at that time a conservation easement must be placed on the property to protect, again, the historical character and the qualities of the property. He said the municipality can hold that easement and or the state. If the municipality doesn't really want to get into that, the state would hold that easement. And basically what that is for is, so if I decide to buy the property and my whole desire is just to raise it, he said they don't want that to happen and someone just buy it and take that property down. So if a private property or a private owner would buy the property, again, they would have to go through a similar process that the municipality would if they decide to do any work on it or if they decide they want to raise that property. It's a little more stringent than it is for the municipality, but again, they don't want someone to purchase a nationally registered historic building and then turn around and raise it. So there are some criteria that way.
Tracy, this strikes me as one of the few opportunities we have to bind future boards to a certain decision that we make. And it's really not binding. It really only limits it to a certain number of days that they would have to wait for, which strikes me as just being prudent. Right. So what we're binding future boards to is being prudent when they're dealing with historic municipal buildings.
Yes. He said that, you know, we could come to him and say, we have had this on the market for 2 years, and no one wants to buy it. So we really are to the point where we want to raise it. And, you know, there's just no interest. We're not using it. We don't want it. He said they may come back and say, well, here's a list of people in the state that have purchased these types of properties, or they're interested in these types of buildings. We would like you to do an RFP. We would like you to get out to these different vendors or these other individuals that have shown an interest in the past. Give a little more time. See if there's anybody that comes up and steps forward that would have an interest in it. So that's the type of thing that they may require, as if you were looking at, you know, demoing or raising the building. So you're correct. I mean, they can't totally deny it or stop it, but they can slow it down.
I know we replaced the floor in the community center a few years back. That would be something that we could still do. Is it just windows and doors? And I can't remember what they said when they were here visiting. Jim, yeah. You might know. It's only exterior. Okay. Trustee Zeller.
I have two questions, Tracy. The last time that Jim O'Rourke was here to speak with us, that question was raised concerning whether we approved an initial survey or a final survey. Has that question been answered?
Yes, it has. I did talk to both our attorney and also the State Historical Society and see if there was a concern with those two terms being used. The state does not have an issue with it. The state said there, either way is fine. In fact, the state said there isn't a requirement. There's not a public hearing on that grant or anything. It just is at a public meeting. And they did not have a concern with the verbiage that was used. I also talked to Dennis Duffy, or had Dennis Duffy weigh in on it. And his response was, a survey of historic sites in the village of Alloway is sufficient public notice on an agenda item. The use of initial or intensive to describe the survey doesn't change the substance of what was noticed for consideration by the public bodies. So he does not have an issue with those terms as well. And, you know, as we were doing this process, we interchanged initial and intensive a lot back and forth as we went through the process. So neither the state or our legal has any issue with how it was listed and how it was posted, and does not see a requirement for anything to happen or to go back through or anything.
So it's an initial approval. Is that our understanding?
It's the terminology, initial or intensive, is the fact that it was listed that it's a historic, trying to think how it's, approval of one set, the initial survey of historic sites in the Village of Alloway, and one set, approval of the intensive survey of historic sites in the Village of Alloway. What our attorney is saying, what the state is saying, that the fact that we are approval of historic sites, of a survey of the historic sites in the Village of Alloway, is fine. So it works either way, because it's we're still approving a survey of historic sites in the Village of Alloway.
So have we approved the three historic districts?
Yes.
That Jim referred to, we have already approved those historic,
yes,
districts.
Yes.
And excluded the other eight that Jim referred to.
Yes, the state, when the consultant came and did the windshield survey and toured the whole community, like Jim said, she came up with 12 districts, I believe, or 11 to start with. And what happens after she goes and does all of her initial survey, or intensive survey, whatever you call it, of the community, then she takes a state representative out and he tours the community with them, and she tells these are the districts that they felt were, you know, could be potentially districts, and these are the homes or the areas that they would look at as well. And the state has final say on whether what districts they will allow and what homes they will allow. And that's what they came back with. They said these are the three districts that fit the criteria for a potential national register, and these are the homes and these are the buildings that fit the criteria for a national register. So these are the ones that we will approve, or that are in the survey, that were approved in the survey. So the state does come and do that. There's a gentleman from the state that comes out and goes out with the consultant.
So have those three districts been approved as national, yes, historic districts now?
They have been approved as potential to, we have to go through the whole process.
Potential.
Yes, they are eligible for nationally historic districts. Yes, and that's what, like our municipal buildings, they are eligible for national historic register.
Okay.
And then we have to go through the process where a consultant goes through and does a more in-depth study of the buildings and or the district if we are going for a district.
Okay, so that leads to my second point, my second question. The two buildings, the community center and the waterworks building. A number of years ago, the Public Works Committee asked for and received an assessment or an estimated appraisal of the Public Works building from Dennis Bonk. And he appraised that building and land at $38,000 approximately, because there's a 500,000 or 1 million gallon water storage tank behind that building, and I went and looked at that building, and it's in pretty tough shape. I don't want the village to be bound to improvements of that building, and having to go through all the steps that we just talked about or just heard about to sell that property, because we've turned off the electricity to that building, the heat, the power. It was, in my mind, our intent was to sell that building. So I would not support that as being one of the two eligible or that we are requesting historic status for. The community center, certainly, yes, but the that waterworks building, that concerns me quite a bit.
Tracy, do you remember why is it on the eligible list? There's a difference between historic and dilapidated and old and neglected, right? So
I don't know if I can put my hands exactly on why it was listed unless it has it, exactly why it's...
In that building, all the pump and mortar mounts still are remaining there in the building, sticking up out of the surface. The surface, there is a garage, a single stall garage in there that's empty, but to my knowledge, we're not using it at all for anything, and it's just costing us money to maintain it. So.
Yeah, you're correct. I don't think it's being used for anything anymore, but it is a... We've had some interest in the past to purchase it and, preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, nobody has come forth or, we've heard, but we haven't had anybody step up and do it. But
we never did, just to interrupt you on that, we never did list it for sale formally, though.
No. Yeah, I don't think it has been either, at least since I've been here. But, it is a unique building. It's, you can, some people like it, some people don't. I mean, we did a tour of it with the Historic Preservation Committee. We went and toured it. Some of them really liked it, some were like, oh my gosh, get rid of this thing. So I guess in the eye of the beholder, and it does qualify from an experienced person, or I should say someone that knows what they're looking at, had said that is a facility, or that building is one that has some value to it historically, and that's why it was listed on the National Register, and it is the architecture of it, put it on the register, so... everyone's different in their thoughts on it. I mean, like I said, some of the historic preservation people did not like it at all and thought, why did we have this building? But
again, my understanding is if it were to be on the registry and we decided, no one's buying this and it's costing us to even keep it from being a hazard and we wanted to sell it, that we could still do that. There'd just be a little bit of a process and they would make us go out to bid amongst people who they know have bought these in the past. And I just got back from a vacation in Cedarburg, and a lot of those buildings, I could tell, if they hadn't paid attention to them, they would have been run down. And now they're some of the neatest buildings, and they're just attracting people to that area left and right. And
I mean, it has some value to do it. I mean, that area down there has got kind of a nice commercial area. It's got a nice little strip mall, and it's got some other buildings, some commercial areas. So, maybe the right person... seeing that would purchase it and really take care of it and like it. You don't know, and maybe it's listed, you have more an interest in it as a listed site, that may bring more interest into that facility.
Jim, would there be more interested in something that's on the registry?
Well, first of all, you make a great bike shop.
You make a great bike shop.
Perfect.
It would.
But my objection to it is that architecturally it does not meet the federal guidelines because the primary facade has had a major renovation. The garage was added on, and so this is a private agenda item. It really doesn't qualify. But if the consultant wants it to qualify, it's going to qualify because of the rubber stamp. So this, and I only know from what I've learned from them, is does not qualify because of the major modification to the primary facade, which would be the garage. So it doesn't qualify. But with that said, that would make a great historic district for those buildings down there, because it would be charming and that it would support people in that neighborhood. If you renovated the property across the street and the Zesty's thing, that would be a good commercial historic district, and that would be the appropriate approach to say we're going to make that a nice little historic district, and there's funding that goes along with the commercial aspects of preserving those buildings. But they don't like the rest of the commercial buildings down there, so they only gave it to that one building, and that would be a nice little commercial district that would qualify under the federal program, especially tying together the Zessi's building and the printer building and some of the other things that would need some renovation, but that's a nice little label.
Some of those, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any further discussion? Jim, did you want to add to this now? Your idea is to add to this letter of intent.
So my
money to hire an intern to fact check on the survey. Pardon?
Yeah, correct. It was because the state doesn't object to the term initial versus final on the survey, I suggest that you relabel the survey that you just approved as the initial survey and request the final report be prepared, and that the state go ahead and pay for that. And you can request up to $25,000 for the state under this letter of intent. But since they don't object to the verbiage, initial versus final and intensive, then if you relabel it as a initial survey, you can do phase two, which would be your final survey, and you can ask the state for $15,000 to $20,000 and go through the RFP program and pick somebody appropriate.
Simple to be true.
Yeah, and how did Sheboygan go through three phases? Because you said Sheboygan actually had three.
With the same contractor, and it took 3 years, and she lived in town. And that was a very well-done program.
Okay, so the initial was done. What happened in the second, and what happened in the third in Sheboygan?
Funding. Additional funding.
Well, yeah, but
so
what actually
you're
got done?
You're restricted. You can't ask for more than $25,000 a year. So a multi-year program allows you up to $75,000. I don't know how much they got for it, but you know, you're limited because they only have a budget of $88,000.
Yeah. I get the money part, but what did they actually do in the second step of their survey?
They evaluated different areas, and they took their time, and I wasn't a part of that. I just
so they just got a much more in-depth product.
They had time to review it and discuss it and to filter it through, and they ended up with 13 historic districts. They ended up with the same count as we did. It just took them 3 years, and they got 13 districts, and we ended up with I didn't know it until tonight. Of the 12 districts, we actually only had 11 originally, and one was added on, and then one that was added on must have been the Lombardi district. But it gave us an extended period of time, gives people time to make sure that their home is properly rated. And the correct term is potentially eligible certified historic resource. So all 5,000 properties in Alloway start out as a yes, that is potentially eligible. And then once if it's less than 50 years old, those drop off the list. If they've had major renovations to the front of the house, those drop off the list. But everybody's entitled to get that positive statement that says, yes, when we look at your house, we're going to give you a passing grade unless you don't meet these criteria.
And that's what I asked the state for, and they haven't given me a checklist yet, and I've been waiting for 2 weeks for that. So it's a checklist. If I look at your house and I look at your house and you have identical houses, just you live next to Vince Lombardi and you don't, I got to use the same criteria. I should be able to use the same criteria on both your houses, regardless of who you live next door to. And so,
but wasn't there some criteria for a cultural significance?
That
is it social significance? Isn't that the
so
criteria
you get,
they were using?
So for that, you get extra points. And that for the cultural significance, that particular structure gets a free pass. The whole neighborhood doesn't get a free pass, only that house. Whereas in, they would like to see the whole neighborhood get the free pass.
I see.
Because it's so, and it doesn't get any better than Lombardi. I mean, you know, they named the trophy after him, in Super Bowl. It doesn't get any better than that story. But the neighborhood doesn't qualify. Other neighborhoods are much better. And you ask me about which neighborhoods it would be the Camp Smith District, which would be primarily around the Oakwood Avenue, between Green Avenue and Mission. That was one of the areas that the contractor really liked, and that has the and that's a very good historic district. But that's just one example. Some of the other areas that we might have some more modest homes that need a lot of renovation. You have maybe some crumbling foundations and that type of stuff over by the river. She identified one of those neighborhoods as a good potential historic district. And if those people put $10,000 into fixing their foundation and putting a new roof on, they get 25% of that back from the state for being in a historic district. So that's why this is important. I love the Vince Lombardi story, but there's lots of other historic areas that also qualify.
Jim, why would they give us more money to check up on work that they had done?
Because they did it wrong.
But if they...
So I'm on the record, and I know I'm being recorded, I'm sorry, Jim, you know.
But it would be an admission that they did it wrong if they were to give us the money.
Correct, and the only way
that... Is that ever going to happen?
Yes, by requesting the money, it has to go to their boss in Washington, D.C., and they're going to say, what the heck happened there? And if they have to refund this study again, they're not going to be happy, and we're not going to get any more funding from this historic preservation. And the only funding they really have are the tax breaks. So they really they fund studies and they give tax breaks, and that's what they do.
Well, but I have a question. They did this with Sheboygan, so I mean, there's precedents for this.
Three phases.
One municipality. There is a precedent,
right.
But it's one municipality.
One municipality, same contractor.
Hundreds that.
Right,
no,
but they've already done this with one. And I tell you, downtown Sheboygan, if you've been
was
down
the
there,
same,
they're historic district.
Was it the same situation where they had a initial or a first round, and then they said, oh, wait a minute, let's keep going? Or was it
a
plan from the beginning to have?
It's a little bit older now. It happened.
It might have been, let's take this in three stages.
Yeah, that's
from the
get-go.
Whereas ours is, wait a minute. You guys screwed up. Come back. Give us some more money so you can come back and do it again.
You've done it with another one. We have as much to offer.
What does the Historic Preservation Committee think about this idea? I mean, it's not on the agenda as an action item, and they're just sort of informing us that this is where they'd like to go. I'm getting the sense of from Trustee Zeller that we might want to take this up for vote for the municipal buildings. Trustee Zeller, is that
well? Right, and if the deadline is September to respond with a letter of intent, we don't have time.
Well, you said mid September, but I don't know exactly what.
Right, mid September, the letter of intent has to be sent to the state.
So we wouldn't have time to vote at our next meeting in September and still have them get the letter of intent to where it needs to go. Is that correct?
Could we change our intent? It's just a letter of intent.
I'd have to check. Maybe we could. I don't know for sure.
It's my understanding that they need it for budgeting purposes, that they want to know what you're going to be asking in your official letter. So you need to let them know that we're thinking of doing the municipalities, and so that they can say, okay, that's going to cost $8,000, and that if we say that we would like the final survey done, and we'd like $15,000 for that, they just need to know it. You're not obligated to take it. You're not obligated to do it. It's just saying, for your budgeting purposes, this is what we're going to be asking for in November.
Would it, could it jeopardize the municipal? Well, we have two issues here. We have the municipal portion that we're, I'm not convinced the board is all agreeing that both buildings should be in it. So that needs to be voted on by the board at the next meeting. However, that's not in time for the letter of intent. So I would recommend that the letter of intent be worded that there's the possibility of a second building, but we don't know whether that second building will be included in the project. And the second issue is this asking for additional funds for a second phase of the report, of the analysis. Is it possible that their willingness to fund anything in our entire letter of intent will be jeopardized by the fact that we're asking for this second dual portion?
Yeah, they may tell us to go away.
I would suggest that there's a lot of speculation on what happened in Sheboygan. Nobody knows what really went on, how they got three grants, if they got three grants. Maybe they got one grant, just like we did for initial survey. They did the initial survey, then they went and said, okay, now we're going to look at this area, and they did got a second grant, just like we're looking for a second grant for potential municipal. Then maybe they went with another grant for another area. So nobody knows, and Jennifer did that. Jennifer also has her business in Sheboygan. So maybe she has some deal where she worked with Sheboygan and helped them through and did some things pro bono, or who knows what really occurred with that. So I think that should be found out, what they did. And the state should be asked, if we apply for this final review or a review of the grant, is that something they're even going to fund or even consider while we're talking about all of this? I mean, find out what they would do or what they wouldn't do. And, you know, Historical Preservation isn't interested in going there right now. They would like to start smaller and do it and have taken care of. They like this document. They support this document. They don't think there's issues with this document. It was done well. They're comfortable with it. And we have one gentleman that is not. And that's really what this is. And unfortunately, Jim was saying he gave all this information to us, or he did not give anything to Jennifer on this project, nothing. And he's saying he has, but he has not. He would not release any information. So if there's things in here that maybe Jim feels should have been in here, they weren't given. And they couldn't be put in because he wouldn't share them with the consultant. So the Preservation Committee has no issue with it, and no one else has had an issue with it. And you know, it's just one gentleman that knows a lot about history, give him that. But he, and we sat down for 3 hours with the state, with Jim, that talked specifically about the historic suburb. And they went through why we don't qualify, why we are not in that category. Went through all of that with Jim. For 3 hours, we went through all the questions he had. And it, he just doesn't agree with what the product was or what we're getting there. Whatever, I think that's the biggest issue.
We talked about revisions to the document, too, and the state seemed to say, well, yeah, if there's something that we missed.
Yes.
By all means, you can, document, you don't have to wait 10 years in order to update the registry.
It's a living document, and it's not, it can be, it's designed to be changed. It's a starting block for the village. A way to start with your historical preservation and to look at areas and look at buildings and all that. So it can be changed. It can be added to, and things can be changed on the register. So it's not set in stone. We're not stuck. We're not, you know, can't ever do anything else. That's not true. It's something that can be adapted and can be changed, and that's the way they do there.
Okay. Well, we have a problem that we have no ability to vote on any of this tonight. And so all I can give you is I get a sense that when the letter of intent is written, that second property, it should be phrased in such a way that we don't know at this time, but we'll know soon whether that second property would be included in the
in the project?
I did find a couple hundred examples of where I did contribute.
Every time you see a date in a column that is a real date instead of a circa, that's my data that I provided to them, and it's throughout the entire project. So this is the database that I talked about that I acquired, that I had in my, through my business, that I had kept from the old assessor, and that formed the foundation for this entire document. And then they retyped it, and they made mistakes on it, but they retyped it, but I provided the foundational information for them that was also included in the original solicitation. So I did the analysis. I told them how many properties there would be. There's over 5,000 properties. I spent a lot of time on this. And so I contributed here. There were properties that I told them to investigate, such as the Johnson Shipyard, which is the Grayling Shipyard, which is where we would like to do the TIF district and the TID district down on Marine. And I asked them to look into that, and they did a quick look into it, and they said, nope, there's nothing there, nothing worth talking about. That was one example. I talked a lot about the trolley districts, and, for example, the trolley stopping over at the greenhouse, right, and Schrader's Flowers. They completely ignored the trolley, and they said, nope, there's no resources with regards to the trolley, but the reason that we have medians on Webster Avenue is a direct result was the road was on one side, the trolley was on the other, and we now have the most beautiful main thoroughfare because of the trolleys. And when they took up the trolley line, they put the line down and left the median, and now we have the beautification committee taking care of the area in front of Schrader's Flowers and the whole trolley. So those are some of the examples that I came up with that were continually rejected. And
all right, we're in a tough spot here because we can't vote on any of this.
Okay, I just wanted to leave one more thing.
We can't make the Historic Preservation Committee do anything right now because we can't vote. So, again, all we can do is give them some friendly advice that the board does not agree on whether or not both properties should be included in this letter of intent.
I do have the page for
the... I'm comfortable with that in terms of the two municipal sites, that we're not committing to both of them in the letter of intent.
I would like to add, I do believe that listing might enhance marketability with the tax credits. So,
what listing?
With the historic listing.
That second municipal site. Okay.
Might.
Good point. Trustee Genrich.
Oh, what about the other? Would it be prudent to draft some kind of a statement reinforcing that our intent or thought was this was an initial survey? Or at what point do we do that? It sounds like it could go either way, but do we want to go on?
Yeah. In my mind, I think we asked a lot. I asked a lot of questions that night, and I'm no expert in it, but I asked about the process and where it goes from here and what are we really doing, if you recall, and then it has to go to the federal level, and I asked who really makes that determination. He said, well, the feds never deny anything that we basically agreed to at the state level. And in my mind, it was pretty clear that we were passing it on, and that was going to be it. And if it wasn't clear in your minds, then that should have been brought up for reconsideration at the very next meeting. But... And like I said, in my mind, especially the term initial applied because we weren't approving anything final. That's not our job. The state was doing that. We were sending something forward to the state. Yes, Debbie?
The minutes that I just typed up, the actual agenda item said initial, but your presentation was of the intensive survey report, and when you approved it, that's what you were approving.
Okay.
So that's how I had it. The motion was made to approve the intensive.
Okay.
Survey.
Thank you.
If that helps at all.
So then the question became in the last meeting, did we not represent it to the public? Well, did we mislead the public by the agenda item saying initial and then voting on intensive? And so that's when Tracy brought it to our attorney and he said, no, the spirit of the agenda item was preserved. I think what he basically said was if someone was interested in historical preservation, they would have come whether it was said initial or intensive, and there was no problem with going forward. So... That's where my main concern was. I don't want to get in a situation where we're holding meetings and we're not properly notifying the public as to what we're talking about. Does that help answer your question?
Yes.
Trustee Green.
I just, Tracy, before this comes back next week, can you find out what happened in Sheboygan? Because I have to say, I am so impressed with their downtown district, their downtown business district, their historical properties, and they have done a fantastic job in Sheboygan. And I just, it would be interesting to know what their process was and how it was different and if there's any lessons to learn there for us. Thank you.
I do have the comprehensive plan from Sheboygan, page 144, that says that it was, they hired LJM, who is Legacy, to prepare the report, which was conducted in three phases between March 2002 and January 2006. So this is what you'll be asking. Yeah, I'll just leave this.
I don't know if we have any other further direction for Tracy. I think that's basically all we can give you right now. I would recommend that, I'm sure these conversations have taken place, but it's up to the Historical Preservation Committee what they put in this letter, and I think the caveat that makes sure that the recipients know that we're not sure about that second property is the best we can do. Okay, moving on to item number 8. Action regarding the request from Resurrection Catholic Parish for a temporary Class B fermented malt beverage and wine license for the gathering on September
10th. So move. I want to give credit for that.
I heard a second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. No special dispensations for you, Trustee Kovish. Item 9, action regarding the disallowance of claim as listed here for insurance services. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Green?
I'd actually like to hear more about this because what we were given in our packet doesn't tell us anything. It tells us nothing.
You know, that's very
exactly. So
we don't know.
So
there's no motion until we have the.
There's no names, no incidents.
There's no anything.
Other than that, it's
clear. Basically, what this is the insurance company of a resident that experienced a sanitary sewer backup in their home filed a claim with her insurance, which is what she should have done, and her insurance took care of it. Took care of it, but then counter-served our insurance company. Oh. Our insurance company is denying it to her insurance company and is asking the board to uphold the denial, and then it starts at state statute for disallowance of claim. It's limited to 6 months. So just like you've done in the past, when the insurance company has disallowed a claim, they ask you to do a formal denial, and then it starts at 6 months. Statute of limitations, 6 months. So that's the background of it.
And there was
but in
nothing.
The past, there's been some details on what actually happened and what's disallowed,
yeah.
Right? In this case.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, the reason there was not with this law is because it's not actually with the resident, it's with the resident's insurance company, and the insurance company is counter putting it against our insurance company. Our insurance company is denying.
But we've had that happen in the past as well, I think, haven't we?
Yeah,
where an insurance
resident.
Company has tried to sue our insurance company. That
it probably has. I would think in the past that we've had that happen before.
So our insurance company shouldn't expect us to be approving something that unless we were supposed to look up by the numbers.
Right, yeah.
The case number.
So there was nothing wrong with our sewer at all in the investigation?
That's what our insurance company is saying, yes.
What does our public works department say?
That's what our insurance company is saying, that there is nothing. So that this denial is based on our insurance company saying there is no liability. We didn't do anything. We did our ministerial duty. We took care of it. There is no advance notice of any issues that would impose a ministerial duty upon us. So the criteria that they set forth when they look at an insurance claim is exactly what's stated on here. So we did not fail to perform any of our duties.
Were there any other residents similarly affected in that neighborhood?
No.
Just isolated incident.
Is there a motion with regard to this item? Is there a motion with regard to this item?
I have another question. Why don't they provide the addresses and so on? I mean,
yeah.
there's really no basis for anything with this, and probably including the homeowner not understanding what's going on other than mm-hmm. a bunch of babble from the insurance companies.
I can check and see about giving you, putting on a different agenda and getting you the address of the person.
I don't really
complaint.
Need to drag it on. I was just curious if you knew.
And do we know?
Just because the claim came from the insurance company versus the resident is why it's stated the way it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be the same denial letter. Just with the resident's name on it mm-hmm. and address, then, but with the insurance company going after us, that's what it was stated in this manner.
Can you ever think of a situation where we wouldn't accept the denial?
I mean,
that's why we have insurance companies, right? Like, okay, you figure it out. Because then all we're saying is we're going to sort of abandon our own insurance company and we're going to take this on ourselves. And,
well, no, but we'd at least like a little information.
No, I understand that, and you want a little information, but I'm just wondering about these types of vote. I didn't get a motion, and so I'm wondering why. One is that there is very little information, but even if there were lots of information and we thought we might disagree with what the insurance company was doing, would we actually
do it?
Do it?
Yeah, but maybe, and we should have that choice. With the
I understand, but
lack
I'm just sort of reflecting.
We're all on the same team. There's no
right,
doubt about
yeah,
that.
It's
this is like, where's the information?
I understand that.
This, to me, takes like rubber stamping to the next
I
level.
Understand that. I get that.
Don't have a clue, and I'm uncomfortable with that.
I can bring it to the next meeting if you want to put it off.
Sure.
And we'll bring the name of the person and the address.
And I assume
I'll check with the insurance company, but I, you know, this is what they sent to go through the denial process.
Okay.
So this is what we received, and then we have a letter that we send out to them after it's approved.
So I'm assuming the
Public Works.
Pardon?
Or something for Public Works.
Yeah, where's Craig?
He's on vacation.
timely.
Well, there's other things that, and I'm not going to get into it, but.
I caught that from the speech you used.
Okay, I would make a motion to postpone this until the next meeting and get more information as to the details of the incident from somebody's insurance company, starting with our own. Is there a second?
Oh, enthusiastically.
Trustee Green, second. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Item 10A from Park Rec and Forestry from August 27th, recommendation regarding the retaining Ayers and Associates design landscape for Sunset Park Trail. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Green?
I'd move to approve.
Trustee Gendrich?
Second.
Seconds. Discussion? Brad, do you have anything to add?
Just that Ayers did the initial design and did the contract for, the construction of the trail, and we removed the landscaping out of it because we weren't sure where the numbers would come in.
Yeah.
So we're bringing it back separately.
Trustee Zeller?
Brad, when the initial plan was done by the students at NWTC, was that plan taken in part or in whole and incorporated into the Ayers plan? Or is this
the plantings better not be? I remember some of those plants were really expensive.
For the most part, the design of the trail was in there, except for they had to make some modifications because the they didn't do a survey, so they did not have the actual kind of
the elevations.
The elevations. So Harris had to make some adjustments to it, so it was pulled a little bit further away from the property line. The South Park property line is brought closer, a little more to the north, and the curves are a little more gradual.
And then there were some plantings that would have been more labor intensive to take care of and such, and so that's what
Harris will come back with.
It is
a different plan.
Okay.
Utilizing some of that, Park Committee looked at Craig Hsu from Harris was under Park and Rec Committee, and we had the initial plan that the NWTC students put together. We went through that kind of what could come out, what should come out.
Okay.
There was some pretty intensive stuff.
All right, so you support this.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Brent, I'm not remembering the rules for when we have to go out for bid. Is it okay for us to...
Yes, this is okay.
Is it because of the dollar amount that we...
An engineering firm, you do not have to go out on bids unless you're utilizing... This would also fall under the extension of what
they did before.
The original scope of service.
Okay, correct. Thank you. Any further discussion? We have a motion and a second, correct?
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 10B, action regarding the recommendation regarding the Rush Family East River Trail Reconstruction Project timeline. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Dart?
I move to approve the new timeline.
Is there a second? Trustee Green?
Second.
Discussion?
Does Brad have anything to say on it?
No, doesn't look like it.
No. Seems reasonable.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. 10C, action regarding the recommendation regarding the formation of an advisory committee for nuisance animal control, the turkey and deer issue, and its structure. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Green.
I would move to follow the recommendation of Park and Rec.
Is there a second? Trustee Gettard, seconds. Discussion? Brad, now we're talking a little bit before the meeting tonight, and Brad, I think, hit the nail on the head with this one. When this turkey issue came up, he said, look, we have to slow down and make sure that we get public input, and it's a good thing we did because there are surrounding municipalities that are dealing not only with that issue, mm-hmm. but with this deer issue. I think it makes good sense to take them both at once and make sure that the public is involved as possible by forming this committee. So I'm fully in support of this recommendation. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. 10D, action regarding the recommendation regarding the allowing the construction of a disc golf course on village property. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Kopisch?
Move to approve.
Is there a second? Trustee Green, seconds.
Second.
Discussion?
Looks like a great opportunity, Brad. I don't know if you have anything to add. This has been somewhat in the works for a while, different locations.
Yeah, it's been in the works for, I would say, probably 8 years.
Well,
and,
wow.
A new gentleman came on board and has a lot more energy and has started to raise a lot of funds. So I think it's a good addition to, and it's going to tie both Alloway and DePere, because part of the course will be in DePere and part of the Alloway. So it's a real nice addition.
Who's the driving force?
Preston. Sorry.
Pearson. That's right.
Sorry, I don't have his name on print offhand. I know it's Preston.
That's close.
Okay. Thank you.
Do we have any idea how many people this is going to attract? I know it's becoming more popular.
we really don't. I mean, there's a pretty good association around here that play, and there's nothing in this quadrant of the greater Green Bay area, so this will be a real nice addition.
Yeah, we have one out at the university, and I'm amazed at the number of people that are. There's always someone using this course. I think it's a great use of getting people outdoors and getting a little exercise. Do we anticipate any problems with, what about maintenance? I mean, the installation of the course is at no cost to the village. What about maintenance? That'll
be a little bit more discussion with them, but the intent would be that there would be some funds set aside, because there's typically not a lot of maintenance associated with it. Not to say that there's zero, there will be some, and hopefully that this will be all covered. Because the holes are going to be sponsored, so.
Oh, they are?
Yes.
How many holes are we talking about?
It's going to be an 18-hole course total. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a portion in Alloway and a portion here. So we've got holes 4 through 9. And then there's a couple extra. So I think we have 12 total on our.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 11, we'll take 11A through C unless there are objections. Is there a motion with regard to items 11A through C? I will make a motion to approve items 11A through C. Is there a second? Trustee Dart? Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Is there a motion to adjourn? Trustee Dart, second. Trustee Genrich? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.